Our guest now loves the dark. For her, it's a magical time, night time, that transforms the senses and the landscape, but which half of us miss out on half of the time, because we're not outdoors after dark. For Waitakere author Annette Lees, the time after sunset and before dawn is beguiling. It's when the nocturnal world comes alive with night birds, singing insects, dancing moths, native fish, all under a canopy of stars. And says Annette, an outdoor enthusiast since childhood, it's the perfect time to go tramping. She has, she says, a lifetime of night walking memories. After Dark, Walking into the Nights of Aotearoa is her latest book. She's no stranger to 9 to noon. She also impressed us with the joys of swimming in cold water a few years ago. Annette, kia ora, welcome back.
Kia ora, good to be back.
So hard to describe your book because it's so beautiful, it's so poetic, it's so meditative, it takes us on so many journeys, but it's hard to sort of point at one thing. So your mission, I guess, is to take us between the covers a little, if you would, and perhaps start us with why the night is so beloved by you.
Well, I like a good mystery. I think that when our day work is done, which is often very practical, quite fast moving, full of light and colour, and we come to rest at the end of the day, we think that we can be restored indoors, lying on the couch. And there's, I do that a lot too. It is restorative and very pleasant. But if that's all you do at the end of the day, I think you miss a chance for a certain kind of rejuvenation, which it can be spiritual, but it's also just fun and intriguing and interesting and mysterious. And it's accessible wherever you live. You just have to step out the door. And even if you live in an urban area, it's a very different world nighttime. And it sneaks into the even urban streets and suburban streets, just that altered world. We don't have the light anymore and the quite the same use of our eyes, but all our other senses are alert, and there's a lot of interesting things that go on at night. So yeah, no, I'm a real fan of it.
I think we have heightened alert in part for natural safety reasons, so we have heightened alert. The other thing, of course, is increasingly there's an absence of humans at that time of night, whether you're in the city or whether you're outside. And so you get more in tune with things other than the people around you. Tell us about your neck of the woods, though, that features so much in the book.
Well, I'm very fortunate to live in a rural area on the outskirts of Auckland in the Waitakere River Valley. So we're surrounded by bush, but also patches of farmland. We have a wetland here. There's a little stream running through our property. And so very, very mixed ecosystems. And I don't have to walk far before I encounter all kinds of insects. I can hear bird life. We even have native bats that fly over our property. And So, for example, in summer, and actually even through most of winter, there are night singing insects outside, which is a chorus that, from most people, take them deeply back into summer nights of their childhood or nighttime. We've got ludu, the owl calling, which is a very familiar night sound, but if you actually stop and listen, it's a haunting, beautiful call. And if you poke around in the stream, you can see sometimes just above on damp banks, you can see glowworms. In the river itself, the galaxids, a little native fish are out and about. We often see tuna, the eels, sneaking up, even though our stream is very small. So it's a lively time. You can hear weta stroking they've got a kind of a harsh call that it's quite soft, but if you listen closely to it, you can discover where there are wetter where you wouldn't normally have thought. And actually listening out like that, one night we discovered to our great surprise we had wetter in all of the pomegranates hanging on our little pomegranate bush. And when we cut them open, sure enough, each one had a wetter inside it, which we actually learned from listening to that bush at night.
I'm jealous about you having a pomegranate bush, but that's another whole story about where you live. The heightened senses, this is fascinating. Part of it is probably safety, because one of our senses is not able to contribute. Our dominant sense for most of us is not able to contribute as it normally would. Although it does become quite acute eyesight in the dark. What happens to the eye?
Well, we've got, there's two parts to the photo, two kinds of photoreceptors in the eye. One are the cones, and they're the most active in the daylight. So they see colour in detail, and they sit in the middle of the eye. But around the edge of that are the rods. They're sensitive to light, but not to colour in detail. But it does mean the rods, after about 20 minutes to half an hour of being in the dark, if you don't turn your phone on or turn on a light, they switch the predominant, the hormonal prompt in your body switches the cones to the rods. And while the world then is in black and white to you, you can see quite a lot of, you can see shapes. You'll be familiar with this yourself if you walk around at night. You see a lot of landscape shape. You can see some detail, even in the darkness underneath the forest. But certain kinds of the relief of the land and shapes and texture is very prominent. So, and your iris widens as well. So you get flooded with whatever light that there is, much more so than in the bright light of day. Even though you think you can't see, you're actually seeing the land in a different way, and that in itself is really exhilarating and incredibly interesting. You pick out detail that's actually absent under the bright light of the day, because you're seeing shape rather than just light and colours and detail.
What are the other senses that elevate? We talked about hearing, and again, that's probably becoming one of the prominent safety senses that we use out at night, but also the night air and skin. I'm enjoying evenings at the moment because, unbelievably and wonderfully, it's been extraordinarily hot in the capital this January, and I'm finding myself getting out for a stroll in the evening rather than the afternoon, but a regular evening walker anyway. And the air, not just temperature, but our sensation or our experience of the air is different.
Yes, it is. It's in fact, because of the hormonal prompting of the night coming on, the sensitivity of our skin actually peaks at 11 p.m. And so you're actually more able to sense changes in puffs of gusts of winds, and the coolness, because the sun, that big burning sun, is on the other side of the earth. We're in its shade. The earth's shade, and so in that coolness, the moisture comes out of the air, the wind tends to still. So it's definitely a different, moister, cooler feel about the air, which is a release after these hot days of summer.
The quietness too, I think, again, means we perhaps focus on other senses more intensely than vision and necessarily hearing. We might hear for something to happen or a twig to, you know, snap or whatever, but certainly there's room for other senses more than during the day. The tramping that you do, where and for how long will you tramp after dark?
I do a whole variety of things. I really love... these days, I like to get up early. When I'm walking, we'll often start a walk at 4 in the morning, or a couple of hours before light. And then you have a very hasty breakfast, pack up your tent or sneak out of the hut if there are other people in it. So we often take all our gear out and pack it on the table outside so we don't disturb people. Perhaps eat something hastily, and then you just start to walk. And that's just the most delightful time, because you have the company of all of those lovely night animals and insects calling, the freshness of that time of day. And as you say, you're attuned to sound. There's a word for it called, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but I say geophony, which is the sound of physical geography. So it's being alert to even though you may not be able to see a view, but you can feel the view. You can feel an opening of forest in front of you. You can feel if you're ascending a mountain that it's becoming cooler. It's just a delightful time to be walking. And then, of course, the glory of the sun coming up. So this is that fading as we slip back into the dawning light coming. And then walking into a dawn chorus, if you're lucky, in a place where they've been managing pests, perhaps, you get the beauty of the dawn chorus rising, and then hearing all the birds slotting into that time as they find their cues to start. And then the sun pops up, and you're 2 hours down the track, so you've got the place to yourself, and a new day is dawning, and then you go for a swim, Catherine.
When do you sleep, Annette?
I sleep a lot too, so I'm a pretty good sleeper. So on a day like that, yeah, you need far less sleep than you think. I used to worry about being short of sleep, but actually you can run for quite a few days on empty, I find. If you're doing lovely things like this, you don't want to be running on empty if you have to work, if you're working. But no, I sleep randomly. Sometimes I'm late to bed and sometimes I'm early to bed. Usually I prefer to be early to bed and get up early. But there are nights where the moon's gorgeous, or I'm out with some friends walking at night, and then I can walk up until midnight and then sleep in.
There's something restorative about the whole experience, and I guess that's kind of the point of a point of sleep anyway, isn't it? We also have, of course, you tell some ghost stories in the book, and this is interesting because many people fear the dark, and some people fear the dark itself, others feel unsafe, perhaps, out after dark. But as children, our imaginations, in the absence of that vision, would you know, sort of create all sorts of ghouls and bogeymen under the bed, and I can recall having a door that had particular grains, the wood grains formed a sort of a monstrous face that still torments me to this day. So it also kind of encourages our imagination and our storytelling and our myth making. And what's some of that that you explore in the book?
Children can be really afraid of the dark, but there's an exhilaration in that as well. There's true fear of the dark, which actually has a name, archeophobia, but that's quite rare. A lot of people are just unsure of the dark or unused to the dark, and they fear things that they needn't fear. It's actually, there's no animal in New Zealand that's going to pounce on you, and so the biggest fear are humans, and humans are a lot nicer, I think, than that we give them credit for after dark. I've only ever met friendly, lovely people out and about at night. Not to say there isn't crime, but this isn't a book about that. This is a book about things that we can celebrate. But children, I remember a delicious terror of dark. And we used to play hide and seek in the dark and pounce on each other and scream with fear, and I had fears of things under the bed too. And I also remember shapes, things that were hanging in the corner of my room that you knew was a dress or a coat, but your mind just kept switching it into something else. And this is the beauty of, it's a form of storytelling. And I love this aspect too. There are ghost stories in this book, because of course ghosts are something that are presumably out and about in the dark. And in fact, ghosts, one of the stories about ghosts is you see them out the corner of your eye. And of course, that's where the rods are operating, at the corner of your eye. If you turn to look, then things vanish in the dark. So that little wisps and things going on it keeps you alert. But yes, there's some wonderful ghost stories. A ghost story that Paul Rory told me about, a ghost that was in the hooker hut, that haunted that hut, from all kinds of reliable people that visited that hut and experienced a ghostly presence there. But there is something, the other thing about night, which there's been some really interesting research into the impact of fire. I'm sitting around firelight, and anthropologists studying this have found that outside, around an outdoor fire, conversation changes. So discussion in daylight can be quite practical. It's transactional, it's economic, in terms of studying, you know, discussing sort of financial transactions. It can be quite waspish and gossipy. But when people sit around the fire at night, outside particularly, conversation changes and it becomes, the conversations are longer, people talk for longer, they're more storytelling, they're more bonding, they're kinder, and they talk about things that are bigger than everyday events. And I think there's something about firelight, if people are, it's the sound of fire as well, if they replace a live fire with pictures of flames or a moving things of flames, it doesn't have the same effect. So it's the sound of crackling. It's probably, in my mind, it's the feel of the night around us. It's been a safe band of people sitting around outside sharing that space and time. And that time of storytelling and ghosts and so on, they all go together. It's an ancestral thing, connects us to people who've long gone. But also I think just if you're going to see anything out of the corner of your eye, that's the time you would.
I hadn't really appreciated that, the rods being a reason we often catch a glimpse of something in the periphery and then go, oh, what was that? And actually it's the way the eye's functioning. And about the fire.
There might be something out there. There could be.
Probably happy to miss it if there is. Sometimes it's a bit like being underwater, don't you think? Sometimes not seeing what's under there is helpful. But interesting about sitting around the fire, because the other thing is, we're not in full light, so we're not scrutinising each other's facial expressions in detail. We get glimpses in the firelight, but it opens up trust a little bit more, you know. It is a different way of communicating. We haven't looked up yet, and of course there's that whole wonder as well. The night sky, and how lucky are we in New Zealand? There are parts of the world where no one can see what we can see away from city lights. You know, it varies again from night to night and time to time, but this is another whole component of the experience.
Oh, yes. I mean, it really is glorious to be in a place where there's clear skies and not much night human light and gaze upwards. It's really transformational. And that is, if you do nothing else at night, just to go outside and look up at those stars, you can improve your life no end.
Annette Lee-Zaukes, her latest book, After Dark, Walking into the Nights of Aotearoa. It's 26 minutes past 10 on 9 to Noon. What was it in childhood, I guess, that took you this way? There were a few things. I'm fascinated about where you slept until your teens, which gave you a pretty good experience of the night, did it?
Yes, we had our family of six had an old villa built in the early 1900s, in Whakatane, on a street in town, where there were no night lights outside, no lampposts, and our bedrooms were for the kids were a walled off porch, so there was lots of gaps. There were holes in the floor, and it was a lovely old house. I'm not trying to make it sound as if we were in any way troubled by this, but the night air just flowed through those rooms, and because there was no street light, you could put your head underneath the curtain and look outside, and there would be the whole array of the stars, and you could see the moon coming up, and I never felt distanced from the night as a child. It was almost like sleeping in a tent. It was very cold in winter, and in the summer, of course, the mosquitoes flooded in. But if you could set aside those two discomforts, it was a lovely place to sleep as a child.
There was also a scientist neighbour who was an influence.
Yes, he wasn't actually a scientist. This is Jim Duthie, who was the loveliest neighbour. Him and his wife, we used to call her date. Her name was Audrey. And we grew up next to them, and there was a little stile across the fence, and we were in and out of their house always, every day, for breakfast. They used to share the roast dinner off their plates. They'd feed us directly off their forks. They were just lovely. And Jim was an accountant by day for the Whakatane Board Mills. And it seemed like a very ordinary person, lovely, just a very lovely man. But at night, he had a telescope, and he was the president of the Whakatane Astronomical Society and eventually president of the New Zealand Society. But that was after I left home. But he bought this telescope and built a little shed on the back lawn to put it in. And on the night that he brought it out for the first time, and we all climbed over the fence, and I put my eye to that telescope, and he had it trained on Saturn, and I saw the rings of Saturn, and I was just astonished. I just couldn't believe it, that was out there. And we learnt, he had us over there a lot. At any time we wanted to come, even on the nights when the Whakatane Astronomical Society was all crowded around this telescope, because it was pretty rare. I think it may have, at the time, have been one of the only telescopes in town. So a lot of people were interested. He always made space. He always went and got the little wooden box for me to stand on so I could look through and talk about what he was looking at, Mars and Jupiter, the jewel box, looking into the kind of the darkness of the coal sack right in the middle of the Milky Way, and explaining what the Magellanic Clouds were, these mini galaxies of our own in our own solar system. So, yeah, it was a wonderful, enlightening opening of night, of the potential of night for me.
I wonder if there's another thing about New Zealand's geography, which is our twilights, because we're a skinny country, of course. And what happens, I guess, across the country and maybe up and down the country as night falls?
Well, this is one of the things that night will do. It steps you back from your daily world to think about the fact we're actually on a round ball speeding through space, and that's why we have night. There are three twilights, which I didn't actually know until I started researching this book. As we turn away from the sun, the angle that the sun's rays fall across New Zealand changes. So the civil twilight is between sunset and when the sun is about 6 degrees below horizon. So it's called civil twilight because you can actually carry on working. This is sunset, but there's a dimness to the light, but you can see perfectly well. So you just carry on. Nautical is when the sun has shifted a little deeper beyond the horizons, and that's sort of, I think it's 6 to 12 degrees below. You can't see to read. You're pretty much packing up to come inside. But the first stars are appearing and you can still see the horizon. And that's why it's called nautical, because sailors can still navigate with those clues. Then there's astronomical darkness, which a lot of people think is actually true night, but it's not. The sun is shifted even further away. And you see quite a few stars, but the sky is it's a greyish colour, just starting to become greyish, and the sun, you can often just see a very, very faint and distant glow in the west. And then true night comes, and you can tell the difference because in a moment there's that velvety richness of the dark. And that's true night. So if you're sitting outside, especially during summer when those evenings are long, and especially if you're lucky enough to be in the far south, that whole sequence is really, really drawn out. But in fact, because we're spinning so fast through space, and the widest part of New Zealand, it only takes 17 minutes for darkness to cross, like for the leading edge of night to cross the country. And here in Auckland, it's only 60 seconds. So in other words, when darkness arrives on the east coast in Auckland, it's only 60 seconds before it's crossed New Zealand. So that gives you, and it's fast because, in fact, that's how fast we're revolving. We're spinning something like 1,300 kilometres an hour. The Earth spins. So these are these little things, if you sit and notice them and think about them, they immediately transport you from your day world into this world of great mystery and beauty that is the flip side of life on Earth.
Don't you remember as a kid when you were playing too late and you had to get home before day
oh,
was
yes.
disappearing on you fast?
Yeah.
And you were seeing things, and your rods were seeing things in the corner of your eyes as you ran. A lot of social history in here as well, we should say, Annette. The night stealth of World War II, which is very interesting. The Home Guard getting around and knocking on doors reminds us of the sort of cooperation we're doing now. And there was a time in the 1880s where we all had to turn the lights off if there was a full moon. What? To save power. I need to get back to some of that.
Yes, I know. People were astonished by the first night lights. It was seen as just the most incredible advance, but they were cautious not to waste it. So, yeah, there's quite a few examples of turning the if the moon was full, there'd be a rash of letters to the newspaper if the city hadn't turned the streetlights off, because it was a complete waste of burning gas or electricity. It's so different now, where the lights just burn night and day, and we wouldn't dream of navigating by moonlight through the streets. But of course, the moonlight can really brighten up a landscape, sometimes as bright as it feels like day, you know, a strange day if you go out in that light.
Delightful, Annette. Thank you very much. After Dark, Walking into the Nights of Aotearoa by Annette Lees.